podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Sean Dyche sacked. Hello and welcome to episode 37 of this season's Real Football Cast. As always, I'm your host Dan Tracy, and in the next 60 minutes, we'll be dissecting all the hot topics in football. As per usual, we'll be discussing what's been going on in the Premier League and the FA Cup over the past few days, while in addition to that, there are also some off-pitch activities that have caught our eye and they'll be getting our attention in the next hour. It's been another incredible week of football, and this week it's one up top. But what a one it is. That means leading the line and wearing the captain's armband is Carl. So Carl, how have you been since we last spoke?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks, Dan. Not as good on the football front this week, but looking forward to chatting FA Cup and all things Premier League again.
Yeah, it's been a busy week across football, not to mention Matthew's promotion party still on ice. Matthew, if you're listening, it might go over the line tonight. But before we chat all things football, I best do some social media bits. Otherwise, we'll be talking into the abyss once more. So first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can. That's on Twitter, at DanTracy1983. Also, the podcast has its own account, which is at RealFootballPod. And if you want to become a shareholder, all you need to do is follow and join our very elite members club. Talking of clubs, I'm delighted to announce we're now part of the UK's first ever sports podcast network, that being Sports Social. So check out the URL and all the links posted throughout the week on the Real Football Pod account. You can find me via iTunes by searching for Real Football Cast. If you use that platform, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if you like us, leave a review so we move up the league table. Also, I need to mention my content partner, that being betting.com. For all the tips and predictions you'll ever need, visit that website. And the easy way to find all the links is by going to linktree.com/realfootballcast. But adopting the R and the E, you get 10 podcast platforms to choose from. It's never been easier to listen to this show. Right, it's time to go live. And where should we go first? We've got to go to Turf Moor, I reckon, because the news that Burnley have sacked Sean Dyche after 10 years in charge. Carl, it's obviously a gamble by the Burnley board, but is it one that's going to prove incredibly costly come the end of the season?
Yeah, massive shock, wasn't it, Dan, when that kind of news broke? Because I don't think anyone kind of saw that coming. You know, I even thought, well, even if Burnley go down, when you give them what Sean Dyche has done for the club, then I'm sure they'll give him the chance and probably would be the best man to give them the best chance at coming straight back up again. You can only maybe assume there might be some financial elements involved in this and whether the club think that, you know, keeping him in charge if they go down next season might not be financially viable. But it's a strange decision. I don't think you can assume this is one where they're hoping that bringing a new man in gives them a new manager bounce towards the end of the season, because I can't actually see anyone going in and doing a better job than Dyche. So it was a really strange call, and obviously one that I don't think Burnley fans were too happy with and too impressed with, and one that won't endear the new owners to them that much, given going forward. So very strange. I mean, obviously they got a good point at the weekend, so, you know, I don't think anyone would have expected them to go to West Ham and get a point there, given the way Burnley have been playing. But was very strange. But, you know, you have to give Dyche credit for what he's done for that club. You know, we all know he's had his hands tied behind his back, hasn't he? You know, they got in the Europa League. They had that brilliant season, but just never really been able to push on from there with the finances to bring better players in. But he's done a great job keeping him there as long as he has. So I'm sure he'll be sorely missed. And whether that proves to be the right decision they've done, only time will tell.
Well, this is it. Let's focus on the owners now, because, again, we're not going to know why they sacked Dyche. Obviously, the league position is some precursor, but you kind of think, well, why not give him the 38 games of this season? Let's see the lie of the land and then make a decision come May or June or whatever. But do you think there's a certain element of them looking at the Leeds board and thinking, well, they rolled the dice and it's paid off. Maybe we should do the same.
Yeah, I mean, there is an element of that where you can start to think, you know, has the same voice just become a little bit stale over time? And is there a time where you need to move things forward? So you can see where they might have been looking at that. But then you would have thought, they should have done that earlier and given themselves a real chance if that's what they thought. Because given it with 8 games to go in their position, I'd find it very hard for someone to go in and kind of get to know the players and suddenly turn it around in that short space of time. So if this was maybe a month earlier or 2 months earlier, you might have gone, well, okay, yeah, they've made a move thinking we get a new man in, maybe they have a bounce and we survive. This, just with the amount of games there are left to go, this just seems a really odd decision to make at this point in time. And like as we're saying, I for me think Dyche would have been the perfect manager to possibly bring them out of, you know, the Championship and back to the Premier League again. I can't see who they're looking at that they can come and bring in who's going to make a drastic difference and much more than what Sean Dyche probably could have done.
Well, I guess the frustration for Burnley fans is there's nothing in the way of a succession plan at the moment. A lot of people have mentioned Big Sam, but you look at his track record lately and he's become a bit of a fading force in trying to keep teams up. I know West Brom did him no favours, what, 2 seasons ago. I don't think he's really got the appetite for another battle. And as you say, Cole, he hasn't really got the time either. So are we looking at Burnley now becoming something of a rudderless ship between now and the end of the season?
Yeah, you kind of get that feeling, don't you? Because I can't see anyone that they can bring in that's going to have that sort of impact. I mean, I think, I know Chris Wilder's name is being mentioned, isn't he, as a possible candidate. And I know, obviously, he was getting questioned about that after the weekend's fixtures there. So I guess, you know, you could maybe look at, they're looking at him thinking, well, if he can get Burnley doing what Sheffield United did and playing that sort of football, then maybe he can bring us back. But it's just an odd decision because that is a gamble as well in itself.
Well, let's look at the board, because in terms of their owners, that being Burnley, of course, American owners come in, what, I think it was last season, and they did a leverage buyout, which was similar to Man United all those years ago, obviously on a smaller scale. But when you look at Man United, there was uproar when the Glazers did that, and look where they are now. It's kind of gone under the radar at Burnley in the sense that they've taken a lot of money, a lot of cash out of the club, not really put much in the way of funds this season. And when you're sort of looking at penny pinching and the obvious pitfalls of relegation, you kind of scratch your head as to why Burnley's owners are doing what they're doing.
Yeah, that's right. As you say, they came in, didn't they, and taken a lot of money out of that club. And, you know, the fact that it isn't Man United or a bigger club, no one really seems to care what's going on. And obviously, you know, I don't know too well with Burnley supporters have got major protests about that, or, you know, mega not happy. You don't seem to see too much about it. But given the way that they've come and brought that club and the fact that they could now be facing relegation to the Championship, you also think they might have wanted to keep Dyche on to keep some favour with the fans and then try to build back again and see what they could do. But getting rid of Dyche as well, I think they're probably getting rid of all the goodwill that maybe some of the fans have got to kind of stick with them. And again, if they don't make the right decision and that, say, they go down and the start to the Championship's not a great one, and they don't bring some decent players in that are going to get them out, gives you the kind of impression that you can imagine it could turn pretty toxic pretty quickly there for them.
Well, you look at Stoke as an example of when they fell out of the Premier League, they haven't yo-yoed yet. They've been gone, not come back. So you look at Burnley without Dyche and you can sort of see parallels there already. And with Burnley not really much in the way of funding, it's not really looking like an automatic return to the top flight in a season's time.
No, that's right. And they don't, you know, these are not as well like a club that have got any crown jewels that they can sell off either, have they? You know, you're not suddenly sitting there thinking, oh, well, obviously they're going to sell X, Y and Z and that'll bring them in, you know, maybe close to 100 million that they can reinvest. You can't see any of the squad, you know, Pope, maybe the goalkeeper, he might look to get a move. There will be players, but you're not talking big money either that suddenly they think, well, once we get that money, that helps us rebuild. So that's another issue for them, because there have been clubs that have gone down that know they can sell certain players and that gives them the sort of financial backing for the Championship. That won't happen. Like I say, really odd decision and really odd timing as well.
In terms of Dyche, though, there's always been talk of him getting a Premier League job up the chain, linked with the likes of Palace, Everton, in the past, maybe even more. Those links are going to come about in the summer or the next vacancy, which does materialise. For him, is it a case of getting straight in to the management fire again, or will he bide his time like Eddie Howe and just kind of wait for a real interesting project to take his fancy?
Yeah, because it's a tough move for him next, isn't it? Because you say, Dan, there's always been talk about can he take a step up, as you say, like an Everton or somewhere like that. I guess the one thing that Dyche doesn't really want to do is go to a club similar to Burnley again, where you're again stuck in that thing of, OK, well, yeah, well, you're OK at a smaller side, but, you know, you can't take the step up. But then you kind of think, where is he going? You know, where could you see him ending up? I mean, I don't see many clubs where you think, oh, yeah, you know, they might be looking for a manager next summer, so Dyche will be on the list for them. You know, Watford might be one with someone like Hodgson who might just, you know, stay to the end of the season and then move on. But again, they'll be in the Championship. So, yeah, tough one. I can't really see where he's going to go next, to be honest.
Well, I guess he's almost tainted by his work at Burnley. Unfairly, you could argue. But as you say, with his brand of football being what it is, where does he slot in? I don't know. If he took him to another club, it might be a real mishmash of styles and it could be something that doesn't work completely. So, you know, Premier League managers are always, I guess, more attractive when they're in a job. When they're outside of work, it's hard to get back in. You know, Lampard's learned that only recently, taking his time. I know he's a bit fussy, but then he went back to Everton and he's kind of meddling through his way at Goodison Park. But you sort of wonder where Sean Dyche goes. Does he have to go backwards to the Championship to then have another crack at the Premier League? Only time will tell. But let's talk about the Burnley game on Sunday. He referenced it in terms of a draw. Really, when you look at Maxwell Cornet's penalty, it should have been 3 points because that was an absolute shocker of a spot kick, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And as you say, yeah, that, you know, those are the sort of things you can't afford, can you, at this point of the season in their position? You know, you need to be taking advantage of those situations. And yeah, that's one that you just, as a manager, you just think, oh, what have you done? You know, glorious opportunity and a great time to play West Ham, really, coming off the back of what happened in midweek, because you now get the impression that West Ham are probably going to put all their eggs in that one basket. So it was great timing, you know, tired, emotionally drained. That's play them and you can give up an opportunity like that to get the win. So, yeah, they'll be really disappointed because that win as well, you know, would have kind of undone some of the damage that they cost themselves at Norwich the week before, wouldn't it? You know, because no one would have expected them to go there and get a result. So they could have really put themselves back in the relegation fight with a win. A point's not bad, but that win could have been even better for them.
You mentioned West Ham. Do you reckon their performance was steeped in something of a Europa League hangover? Because, you know, obviously, as you say, a great performance against Lyon. I know it wasn't extra time, but they must have put in a Herculean amount of effort. So is that just the effects of Thursday? And as you sort of say, is it going to be eggs in the Europa League basket from now on?
Yeah, I think so. Because, I mean, I think that as big as that fixture was for them, wasn't it? You know, a massive fixture for them, getting through. And then, obviously, the things that, you know, having the teams that, when, you know, Barcelona going out as well at the same time, and now you're suddenly thinking, wow, you know, this is, we really do have a real chance of winning this now. I just think that's probably, you know, drained them a little bit. And given the way the top four race is going and the games they've played, I think now you probably would be sitting there saying, well, listen, actually, this probably now becomes our priority. So nothing stupid in the Premier League. You know, we don't want to now suddenly lose all the remaining games, but the focus has to be on the Europa League now because they really do have a great chance of winning that.
Would you make them favourites?
I think I would, given the way they're playing and, you know, the ties they've got through and the players they've got. I think there is a, you know, it won't be easy. You know, the game they've got, the semi-final won't be easy, that's for sure. But I would think they're up there as one of the favourites to win that now. And, you know, obviously the mouthwatering tie would be a Rangers-West Ham final, oh, wouldn't yeah. it? You know, what a final that would be. So I would like to see it, you know, but, and then ultimately Rangers pip them in the final. Yeah, I guess if West Ham win a trophy before us, Dan, I think we'd never live that one down. But I suppose for them, it's a great fairy tale, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's wide open now, isn't it? With Barcelona being in the competition at the quarterfinal stage, there's always that sense of, yes, but when they meet Barcelona, things are going to get rather tough. But Eintracht Frankfurt have completely flattened the landscape of the Europa League. Rangers getting to the finals not out of the question. Rangers winning it isn't out of the question either with what they've done in Europe, getting the better Borussia Dortmund, Red Star and Braga. It's blown wide open. It's going to be a fascinating Final Four in that competition. But before we move on to the Final Four that happened on Sunday, we just need to mention Ashley Westwood's injury at West Ham. Now, match of the day two didn't show it in full, but I guess from Vlasic's reaction, you didn't need to see it in full, did you? Because it looked really nasty.
Yeah, they're horror injuries, aren't they? You know, I've played a game of football where one of my teammates had an injury like that, and it is sickening. You know, it does take something out of you when you see those kind of injuries. I guess the only good thing is that for those guys, the right medical people are there on hand straight away. You can get that sorted. But it is one of those injuries that when you see the images or you see a picture, you just think, oh, you know, you just think, I don't wish that sort of injury on anybody in a game of football because, yeah, it does look horrible. And as a player, it does take something out of you, that's for sure.
Yeah, I must admit, I dug a little deeper to find the actual injury picture, and blimey, it's not nice. So if you want to look at it, fine, but I don't recommend it. Put it that way. Right, so what I do recommend is talking about the FA Cup semi-finals. And Carl, it took a little while to get going, this one, on Saturday, but Man City versus Liverpool was eventually quite high on the intensity scale once again. This time we did have a winner, and when you look at the way the game panned out, Liverpool would have been incredibly happy with their performance.
Yeah, they would have been, wouldn't they? You know, as you say, you went into it. I think City's team obviously, you know, dropped you a little bit because you thought, oh, right, well, yeah, some of the changes Pep's made here. Is this game going to be of the same sort of quality? Liverpool obviously want to go for it. So they put the strong side out. And as you say, it took a little while to get going. But when it did, it was another one of them encounters that didn't let you down, did it? But I felt Liverpool deservedly won that game. I think they were showing a little bit more. But, you know, again, another great advert for the fixtures between those two teams. And, you know, I suppose they will be glad there wasn't maybe another 10 minutes of that game left, because then you wouldn't have ruled City getting an equaliser out.
It obviously means nothing in the grand scheme of the Premier League, but with that win for Liverpool, does that give them even more momentum in the title race, or do you have to look at the FA Cup game in isolation?
Yeah, I don't think you can read too much into that. I think because of the changes that City made, I think City come away from that game thinking, yeah, OK, we lost and, you know, that is a shame because we probably want, you know, we want to go on and win everything. But we made changes, so we were slightly weaker than we should have been. So I don't think it affects the momentum for the Premier League too much, because I think City will just feel, well, listen, when we get our main players back in, and obviously, you know, the goalkeeper given one of the goals is a major talking point. I don't think it takes too much out of City. And again, what it will do potentially is just give them next spark. It's one less thing to focus on or concentrate on, and they'll just see the rest of the league games, you know, potentially over the line. So I don't think this was I don't think there was this sort of like momentum swing as there was in that league game the week before.
Do you reckon the lack of momentum swing was helped by the actual final score? Because let's say if it ends 3-0 Liverpool, everyone's thinking, well, hang on, maybe it is swinging to the Reds. But the fact that City didn't really lie down, they gave it a little bit extra and found it back to 3-2, you're sort of thinking, okay, they may have lost the battle, but they could still win the war.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I think, you know, Pep and that will just take this, you know, this was a cup game, not a league game. We made changes, and even with those changes, we still only just lost that game. So, you know, that I think is what you take out of it. The way it was going at half time, you know, Liverpool suddenly go on to win that 4 or 5-1, you start thinking, oh wow, you know, that is a major big victory there over your rival. But 3-2, and again, you're sitting there thinking Liverpool kind of hanging on at the end. I think City takes some comfort out of that.
Of course, the weekend before the Wembley outing, we saw Edison try and play out from the back, nearly get caught out. This weekend, we see Zach Steffen try and do exactly the same, have an absolute howler. So apart from wanting the ground to swallow him up, what's the American thinking in that situation? Is this symptomatic of when players try and play out from the back and aren't as good as they should be?
I think so, yeah. This is one of them, isn't it, where a keeper's like, oh, I'll get a little bit fancy here, and all of a sudden, oh, actually, this is backfiring on me massively. It was a really bad mistake, wasn't it? Because you could see he was getting shut down more and more, and the fact you're just thinking, right, come on, you need to get rid of this now, because this is going to be close. A real clanger, and again, one of those that is the sort of thing that you think some managers would go, right, get this geezer off for doing that, because well, you know, what is he playing at? But again, if you're asking your team to play football, I think these are the sort of things, if you ask Pep about that after the game, he probably says, well, that's what I'm asking my players to do. I'm asking them to try that sort of thing. And he brushes it off, where we're sitting there pulling our hair out. But it's something that I think he'll learn from, and I don't think you'll see him try that again in a game now.
No, I guess from a goalkeeper's point of view, if you do that, it almost always leads to a goal. Obviously, Edison the week before was very close to it being a goal. But with defenders, you can make the same kind of mistake and you might have a teammate like the goalkeeper who mops it up. So it's always that little bit of added pressure for a goalkeeper. But as you say, Carl, when it comes to playing like that, it is sort of high risk, high reward that it will happen from time to time. You are going to get these howlers. But if you can break the opposition press by playing like that so many times over, then usually you benefit from it. So I guess you have to take the slight rough with the smooth. But of course, that was the ridiculous of that game. The sublime was Sadio Mane's goal. And although Mo Salah has been consistently quiet in front of goal over the past few weeks, I guess it helps that the Senegalese forward has more than picked up the slack for the Reds.
Yeah, he's been playing really well. And that goal was another example of the confidence that he's in. You know, isn't he come back from the African Cup of Nations, having won that? And he's kind of come back looking like a guy who's got the fire in his belly again and, you know, a lift from that. And that finish at the weekend was just a sublime finish, wasn't it? And he's, you know, they have got some amazing attacking options because, you know, Salah is going to start firing again. So it's kind of worrying because you think, well, once Mane is back in, if Salah starts scoring again, then that front three is one to be feared, and especially the players they've got to bring in. You know, you've got Jota as well there, Firmino, Diaz. It's great for Liverpool that some certain players can take the pressure off of others when it's not going their way. But, that's one of the spectacular semi-final goals for sure.
Absolutely. Right, before we move on to the other semi-final, a quick chat about Erling Haaland. Because as of this morning, that being Tuesday, reports say that the transfer or potential transfer has taken a substantial step forward. So, Carl, is this now a case of when rather than if it happens?
I think so, yeah. I think, you know, obviously City wanted Kane last summer, didn't they? And that didn't materialise. I guess they've had the opportunity this summer to kind of go again and make a move. They've obviously thought, OK, well, Kane might be off the agenda given Conte being there and everything and what happened. So let's go for the next best thing we can get. And obviously Haaland is a brilliant striker, young. Obviously his dad's there, who's played for Man City. So that's probably a big helping factor. I mean, the fee, from what you're gathering, is going to be nothing given the talent. So, you guess it kind of makes sense. It's not great for the rest of us, is it? Because you kind of, again, you're looking, thinking, oh, when you add him to that squad, you then go, wow, you know, who stands a chance next season? But you can't look at it like that. You know, you've got to assume, yes, he'll come in, he'll be good, but we've still got to do our business. But for City, I think it was, we all knew, didn't we, that it was either going to be Kane or him. And now they've got him. And now they've got themselves the second best striker in the league by the looks of it for next season.
Well, I was going to ask, from a Spurs point of view, can you breathe a lot easier now? Because I know there's always the Harry Kane to Man United link, which kind of resurfaces every, what, 2 or 3 months. But you must be confident that Kane's going to be in Tottenham colours at the start of next season.
Yeah, I think it kind of is good news for us, isn't it? Because you kind of knew that when the season ended again, you go through all that rigmarole of the constant riot, Kane to City and all that talk that just kind of is disrupting over the course of the summer. And you never know where you stand. And you are thinking, well, will he leave? Won't he? You know, if Spurs don't do the right transfer business, could he be off? But if you take Man City out of the equation, I don't see anywhere else where Kane goes where you instantly go, well, there's your trophies, you know, because Liverpool are the only other team where you see if they came in, you'd think, well, yeah, this could be a problem. But with those two teams not going to do that, I don't see him going to anyone else, because United, are they really going to be a step above Spurs right now where they are? I don't think so. So I do think that kind of is great news for us, because it might take the pressure off of that come the summer. I mean, I'm sure we will have to talk about United trying to buy Kane. I just don't think if you're Kane, you're looking, thinking, is this really a move that's going to get me trophies any more than where I am now? I doubt it. So am I going to give up my kind of legendary status at Spurs for that? I don't think so.
Well, let's look at the league table as it stands. Spurs are fourth, Man United are fifth. Now, I know people will argue that Man United are a bigger club with all the commercial deals and all that, and that's fine. I accept that. But from a footballing standpoint, as you say, that's the difference between the Champions League and the Europa League next season. So why would you be going backwards? It doesn't make any sense, does it?
you'd kind of just be going from one project to another,
exactly.
Wouldn't you? Because United are basically maybe three or four transfer windows away from being able to challenge City or Liverpool again. You know, we don't even know yet whether Ten Hag can come in and actually have an effect. And he may come in and be a major flop. So I don't think Kane takes that risk because it's not a guarantee of what he wants. And that is ultimately titles and trophies. So it's not a major step up from where he is now.
No, because you want, I guess if you were Kane and you were looking at the options, you'd be thinking Man United need to be on the up and up. They need to be with a new manager in the midst of a project, say 2-3 years of it actually working and progress being made. The last thing you'd want to do is switch from Tottenham to Man United in Ten Hag's first season and it all goes to pot and you're thinking, oh dear, like what have I done? So I think on the balance of probabilities, now that Haaland is edging closer to the Etihad, I think Tottenham fans can celebrate. And Chelsea fans will also be celebrating because they're off to Wembley for a third time this season. The Carabao Cup final repeat is taking place. And although in the end Chelsea got the better Crystal Palace, you'd have to say that the Eagles did offer stubborn resistance in the first, hour or so. But I guess quality did shine through in the end.
Yeah, they kind of put up a good fight, didn't they? But again, it's that lack of firepower really for Palace, isn't it? You know, that main focal point as a forward that's good enough to kind of score the sort of goals that their pressure deserves. They, you know, they were playing some decent football here and there. You know, Zaha was looking decent at times, but they just never felt they had the knockout punch in them. And you always thought at some point Chelsea will find their gear and suddenly start taking hold of the game more and more, which they did. And then obviously the quality that they've got come through and they managed to get that result over the line and put themselves a final space where, you know, this is Chelsea. They'll feel confident in any game, you know, in a final at Wembley. So that they'll be feeling confident they can turn Liverpool over in this one. And it should be a good final, to be honest.
In terms of Chelsea, they went to the Bernabeu days before. It would have been very easy for them to have a hangover, obviously, with the disappointment of testing Real Madrid so much, getting back to parity and still getting dropped out of the competition. They didn't show any real effects. As I say, it took a little while for them to get going, but in the end, it's kind of a case of, right, you know, that disappointment's done with. There's still the FA Cup up for grabs.
Yeah, and they should take some comfort, shouldn't they, in the fact that they actually went and outplayed Real Madrid and unluckily got themselves eliminated from that competition because they played brilliantly on the night, a little bit better defending, and they get through that game where no one gave them a hope in after the first leg. So they did really play well. So that's the sort of thing you've got to come away thinking, well, OK, yes, ultimately we went out, but we went there and did a job and we played really well. So we have to continue that sort of form. As you say, they started slowly. But then it's a, you know, a tense game. Palace are not an easy side to play against. Obviously, they get fortunate in the fact that Palace is probably best player this season, can't play. So that's a major boost as well for them. And ultimately, yeah, you always felt they kind of probably had another gear to go up that would see them through the game if they got in that gear. And they got the job done. So, you know, another good semi-final result for them. They just need to try and find what they're going to do with someone like Lukaku, don't they, for next season? Right. Because something's majorly wrong there, isn't it?
Well, it's just the continuation of the Chelsea striker graveyard. But I wouldn't be surprised if he's shipped out and another entry enters in the summer. But in terms of Ruben Loftus-Cheek, an amazing opening goal, it must be said. He's a former Palace loanee. What happens with him next season? Because, let's be honest, the 2018 World Cup, he was a figurehead of that squad. It's not really gone to plan since. Could he perhaps go back to Palace on loan and Conor Gallagher comes home?
Yeah, I think with the emergence of someone like Conor Gallagher as well, I think that kind of, I can't see him having a long-term future at Chelsea, you know, playing regular football. He's one of those players to me where I think he needs to take that step away from Chelsea now, move to another club and say, right, I'm going to become the main man at this club and try and move my career forward with these. And who knows, you know, if I'm doing the business here with them, then another move after that might come off. But I just don't really ever see him being someone that gets a regular run in a Chelsea shirt. As you say, Conor Gallagher, when you look at the season he's had, Chelsea are going to want to bring him back at some point and integrate him into that side. I mean, where, you know, with the talent they've got, yeah, it's just ridiculous. But I think he probably, you know, he could do with a move away and just try and kickstart his career again. I mean, we throw, I mean, the way I'm talking, Newcastle are signing everybody next season, you know. But again, could he be one of those sort of players that, you know, Newcastle look at and think, you know, you could come and start making a name for yourself and become a big midfield player for us? But I think he needs that move, and he needs regular first team football where he can, you know, kind of develop even more.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Yeah, I think he needs to be the fulcrum of a midfield going forward. I don't think loan moves are going to help him now, although they'll get him minutes. I don't think it helps his career. And as you say quite rightly, the Newcastle shopping list is getting longer by the week. So if you are listening, Newcastle, we've done your scouting for you. Just give us a DM or something. We'll give you all the names. There's probably more to come, but they all kind of make sense in their own way. Bale, Loftus-Cheek, you know, the list goes on. But you look at Newcastle and what they are planning to do, these wouldn't be the worst buys at all. Now, in terms of the FA Cup itself, Cole, I did a quick bit of research, and out of the last 30 years, including this season, 26 of these finals will have been won by a Big Six club. And that doesn't even include Tottenham. So that's five of the Big Six have mopped up, what, five sixes of the FA Cups on offer in the last 30 years. Is this a bad thing, or does it have to be balanced against that the big teams are actually taking this competition seriously?
I think it's to be expected, isn't it? Because as you say, Dan, you know, it shows that the big sides are not writing the FA Cup off. You know, everyone likes to think the magic of the cup is dying. But that winners list gives you the impression that the big sides still want to win it. And ultimately, if those sides really want to win those competitions, given the squads they've got and the players they've got at their disposal, then you would expect them to get where they are and win it over the teams that they're coming up against. So it's not, you know, it's not unexpected. I don't think it takes any magic away from the tournament. You know, the things that take the magic away from the FA Cup for me are things like semi-finals being at Wembley. You know, those are things that I think do more damage to the actual tournament than the teams that are winning it. And, you know, maybe sometimes those games being there at Wembley take that, you know, that edge off for some of those smaller sides, because you used to see some great semi-finals when they weren't at Wembley, you know, in some of those, you know, Chesterfield, you know, the Chesterfield sort of semi-finals, Oldham v United. Those are the sort of things that kill the competition more than the big sides winning it, because as you rightly say, those big sides winning it show that there's an intent for them to win it and that they're still taking this competition seriously.
Do you think we're at the point where semi-finals need to go back to neutral venues? I understand the FA did it in the past to make more money, partly to pay for the new Wembley. Surely that must be funded by now. So is it time to take it around the country once again?
I think it is. And I think if you spoke to every football fan in the country and asked them the question, where would you want to see the semi-finals? I can't think you'd get many that say they want them at Wembley. I think, you know, people are longing for those days where you get a Villa Park semi-final, yeah, you know, an Old Trafford semi-final. You know, those are exciting times. The semis being at Wembley just kind of takes the edge off of it for me. And it kind of does take a little bit of shine off the final. But then we've probably got, you know, we're probably one of the ones to blame for that, aren't we, Dan? Because it was, you know, us and Arsenal getting drawn together that kind of gave the FA, well, should we move this to Wembley given what it is? And someone from that point thought, well, actually, this is a good idea. Look at the ticket money coming through. But I think this is the sort of thing where the FA need to listen to the fan base and what the fans want. Because, and I think even players would probably say to you, no, semi-final shouldn't be at Wembley. So I think they do need to look at moving these back to the sort of way they used to be, because I just don't think they have the same glamour when you know they're at Wembley.
Well, let's be honest, there's enough good stadiums around the country for semi-finals to also be held. You know, Old Trafford, our ground, I don't know, St James's Park in Newcastle, there's plenty of others. Villa Park, not the biggest these days, but still a good ground in the Midlands, probably equal distance if needed. There's a lot of logic there, and I think, you know, the whole road to Wembley shouldn't be going to Wembley twice. It is the whole culmination from round three to the final, and I just feel that you are a little bit cheated in that. Max would be the perfect example. I think I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago about the same question. I said, you know, are you a bit disappointed that you've got a semi-final at Wembley? And he said, I am in a sense because of the tradition of getting there, but also you're kind of never going to say no to Wembley. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword. But I just feel, you know, it's one of the quick wins for the FA, isn't it? If you do that, I think it just gives the competition a bit of a shot in the arm. And who knows, there might be some semi-final giant killings, as you say, around the corner. You know, Oldham being a perfect example, where they got to two FA Cup semi-finals. No, one was at Wembley, but was it 1990 when they took Man United to a 3-3 draw at Main Road? You know,
yep, perfect, that's right, yeah.
Perfect example, wasn't it? And I think that's the kind of shot in the arm that it needs, and I think it's an easy thing to do. So the FA, if you are listening, get it sorted for next season. Right, let's move on to the top four race now. That's taken another twist after Saturday. And Cole, all of a sudden, it looks like Brighton are the kings of North London, as they've got both the better of Arsenal and Tottenham in successive weeks. So I know it's easy for people to look at failures by Arsenal and Tottenham across those 2 weeks, but in doing that, it's unfair not to credit Brighton at the same time.
No, you have to give them full credit because, you know, again, this weekend, you know, they came and did a job, didn't they? You know, they realised the way Spurs wanted to play. They nullified that. They waited their time and they took their chances. And when you look at the first half, they had a number of chances. You know, yes, Spurs were really flat and really disappointing because you just never seemed to get going at all. But you have to give some of that credit to Brighton and the way they played. And, you know, those last two fixtures, they've really put the cat amongst the pigeon because before those games, I don't think, you know, if you were looking through fixtures and form, you'd have said, well, there were two banker home wins and Brighton have come away laughing, saying, well, there you go, look, you know, don't write us off because, yes, we haven't been in great form, but we're still a good side. And you have to give some of that credit to them and Graham Potter for, you know, putting in the tactical masterclass to stop those two sides. So, yeah, Brighton can feel very pleased. You know, we did say, didn't we, that, you know, we can't take this game easy last week because it's not a foregone conclusion. You know, they are still a decent side and they showed it yet again.
Well, who knows? They might show it against Man City midweek and blow the title race wide open. But as for Spurs, I think it's one of those games where it's fair to say that no one had a good game. They just couldn't get on the pulse. It just seemed off from the start. It was quite insipid, I thought, at times. A little bit tetchy in the first half. You had Kulusevski with an attempted elbow and all this kind of stuff. So, an off day. But what do you put it down to? Is this a lack of plan B from Antonio Conte?
I think the problem is when we say lack of plan B, when you look at Tottenham's bench, I mean, there isn't really much to change things and come up with a plan B, is there? You know, other than Bergwijn and Moura, you have no attacking options where you can suddenly majorly change the formation or how people are playing. So I think Conte knows I don't have a plan B because I don't have the players for a plan B. You know, there isn't any central midfielders on the bench. You know, if you may, you know, we'll laugh at this, but if you had someone, say, like an Eriksen on the bench that you thought, right, I can change the midfield up by bringing him on and putting him here, you know, dropping, you know, not having a three up top, suddenly a two with one behind, then you could have a plan B. But I don't think we've got the personnel that allow him to have that plan B. And ultimately, as you say, Dan, it was just flat, wasn't it, all over. And I think the bigger question there that comes in is one that we thought we might have answered the week before, which is pressure and dealing with, you know, having to lay a marker down. You know, we were the early game and there was a real chance to say, right, we win again. Now it's over to you again, Arsenal. You know, what can you respond with? And, you know, is there some of that that's in it? You know, there's lots of things, isn't there? You know, did players do the right thing? You know, I know there's lots of people questioning Harry Kane jetting off to the Masters and going to watch that, you know, given, you know, the point of the season that we're in, and would he have come back? Would that have had any effect on his performance? But I think ultimately it was just flat. They couldn't get going. Conte had COVID during the week, didn't he? So was there the fact that he wasn't on the training ground? Does that have an effect? But yeah, it was just a shame. But again, it's one of those results where people go, oh, Spursy, you know, it doesn't help you lose that tag, does it? Ultimately, we were just lucky that kind of at the end of the day, the result didn't have too, you know, wasn't the worst result given other results and the way they went as well.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a moment. But I guess when you look at Harry Kane going to the Masters, surely that's a non-issue if Tottenham win. I think we're grabbing it. Reasons why, and that's kind of that's not even top of the weird ones I've seen this week, because Barry Manilow has topped Harry Kane. So what do you make of this whole hoo-ha regarding Can't Smile Without You? Because some people are saying, well, that was the precursor of the day, that the music was too flat and the fans weren't up for it, and because of that the players didn't play well. That's quite a reach. Now, you know, A, is it bad music to play before a game? B, can you honestly blame Barry Manilow for this? What's your take on all of this?
I think ultimately, you know, the song has nothing to do with the performance, does it? You know, we're starting to grasp now. And as you say, Dan, even the thing with Kane and the Masters, you know, people are trying to clutch at straws. It was just a bad performance. The song, you know, listen, we know it's associated with Spurs. I have to say, it's not a song that I think should be played before kickoff because it's not an inspiring sort of song. It is quite a dull, drab. And I think the only thing to people loving it is when they can shout Tottenham at one point. You know, and I think it has its place in Spurs sort of, you know, match day. It probably isn't before kickoff. There's probably other songs that you could play that could get the crowd going a little bit more. But ultimately, it's a song, and I don't even think half the players probably wouldn't even know that that song's being played before kickoff. So I wouldn't have thought it has much effect on them, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a strange one, isn't it? I mean, I think it's a fan poll or something, and it's just kind of another example why you shouldn't let football fans dictate what happens on match day. Like, this is going to be a trend, I think, in future. You know, you've got all this sort of NFT and token-based stuff linked to football clubs, and it's all a case of, you know, the pre-match music, and you can vote on stuff. But if you let fans vote on stuff, they come up with horrific decisions like this. So I just feel, you know, Barry, as much as we love you, we can't have this being played beforehand. But we move on, because there's enough Barry Manilow chat for the season. Because although the mood at Spurs was bad by 2:30, it did at least improve by 5 o'clock. And I think Antonio Conte is going to have to send a bottle of red to Ralph Hasenhüttl, because that really was a surprise win for Southampton over Arsenal, especially when Southampton already had the Hawaiian shirts out the week before.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think it was one of them results, wasn't it? You see, I guess the only good thing for us was having come off the back of a hammering like that to Chelsea the week before, there's always that element where the team want to put that right and kind of like, listen, we need to make sure that don't happen. And we give, you know, it's almost like an apology to the fans and we show that we're better than that. So maybe it was the perfect time for Arsenal to play Southampton coming off the back of that result, because you always felt, could Southampton go out with a point to prove? And thankfully for us, as you say, it seemed that way. I mean, you know, they weren't the best side on the day, but they did enough. They hung on. And then ultimately they managed to grab that goal that kind of gives them the win. And Arsenal couldn't respond. And again, I think we've discussed it a couple of times. Is this where we're seeing the fact that the young Arsenal side, the pressure of having to go and get results is just suddenly, you know, starting to show the weight that it can have, and the fact that they've not managed, maybe they're maybe a year ahead of where they can handle that sort of pressure at the moment. So, it, as you say, Dan, from a Spurs point of view, it was kind of the result we needed given our result, and one that, again, for Arsenal, you're sitting there thinking, this is bad news, because, you know, that was one where we desperately needed to get a result, especially with the game they've got coming up next as well.
Well, in terms of this portion of the season, are you someone who just looks at the week to week? I think a lot of people have gone, oh, well, we could have been 6 points clear. But at the same time, we're still 3 points clear. And it's a case of, as long as you're still clear, that even goal difference or a point is enough come the end of the season. So do you look at it as opportunity missed, or just we are where we are and we go again next week?
I think it's for Spurs, it was a major opportunity missed this week, because if we got that win, and obviously, again, you know, Arsenal slip up, and when you consider their next games are Chelsea and Man United, which they're no easy games, you are sitting there thinking 3 points for Spurs this week and Arsenal dropping points, you know, against Southampton, if they drop points away, away at Chelsea. Then I think you start to say that could be Arsenal out of it at that point, you know, because then we've got to go away to Brentford, and even then a point there, you start to say, well, that suddenly starts making it 4 or 5 point gap difference. And at this stage of the season, that's huge, especially with the goal difference as well. So I think this was a major opportunity missed from us this weekend, and one that a win for us and a defeat for them, and with them to play Chelsea, that really could have been a momentum swing, and, you know, defeats that really could have put an end to that chase top four battle from Arsenal.
Well, we look at the Arsenal point of view from the weekend. We shouldn't ignore Southampton. We shouldn't ignore Fraser Forster, because he had an incredible showing in goal.
Yeah, he did, didn't he? I mean, some of the saves were, you know, really impressive. And again, you start to think that's a guy who's got a point to prove after conceding six the week before. You know, he obviously wants to go out and say, listen, I'm not a dud goalkeeper here. You know, that wasn't on me. And I think that was just what Southampton, you know, they were putting it on the line. You know, as you say, their season is over. You know, they are on the beach. But it goes to show as well in the Premier League, even with teams are not necessarily fighting for something, you can't write any of them off at all.
Well, in terms of Arsenal, I don't think you can really write them off because I know they've got Chelsea and Man United this week. You know, on form, it would be logical to say they get no points. But Arsenal do have a sneaky habit of getting points when you don't expect them to. So when you're looking at those two fixtures, Cole, how many points are they getting?
I think they'll get three because I think they'll fancy themselves at home against Man United. So I certainly see the Man United game, a game that Arsenal can get something out of. I think the Chelsea one, I don't see them getting anything out of that. You know, I think with Chelsea having played the way they did in Madrid and then getting through in the semi this weekend, and they still obviously want to make sure that third is secure. So Chelsea won't be going out and kind of saying, OK, well, the season's done for us. I think Chelsea, I can't see them getting a result at Chelsea tomorrow, but I can see them picking points up against United.
Well, OK, Man United, of course, play Liverpool tonight, that being Tuesday. If you're saying that they get nothing against Arsenal, are they also getting nothing at Anfield?
Yeah, no chance. when you're conceding two to Norwich, then defensively you've got a real issue. And obviously, as we know, unfortunately, given the sad events, you know, Ronaldo won't be playing. So he was the one man that you sort of think, well, if you could see any headline, it's Ronaldo scoring a clutch winner to get them something. But I just think, this could turn ugly for Man United tonight, I think. You could see a 3-4-0 result on the cards because defensively they're just all over the shop. And if it wasn't for De Gea at the weekend, you know, Norwich could have had four themselves. So I really fear for Man United tonight. I think they could be on the end of a heavy defeat.
Yeah, you look at United, especially the way they played on Saturday, they are fifth, but it feels like a false position with the fixtures ahead. Let's say that they get nothing from the week coming up. They're going to be sixth, maybe even seventh by the time the fixtures pan out by Sunday. So you're then thinking, actually, although the door is ajar at the moment, it might be slammed shut for good come Sunday.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I mean, like I say, they're not getting anything tonight. And then, you know, I can see Arsenal, you know, I mean, you wouldn't write United getting a result against Arsenal, that's for sure. But again, away from home, that's a tough one. And then the following week, they've got Chelsea at home. And again, the way United are playing, I don't fancy them against those sides that are stronger than them. You know, you could see Chelsea going and putting a performance in at Old Trafford. And as I say, the way they're defending, I think when they come up against a real decent side, they're going to get found out and one that are stronger defensively than Norwich. So, and like I say, you take Ronaldo out for them, then I don't see them having enough to get past those sides. And ultimately, yeah, I think, you know, they would look at the table right now and say, well, we're still in this top four race, but I do see them just slipping back down. I think they'll probably finish sixth, to be honest, for Man United this season, because I just don't see them having enough in those key games.
No, me neither. I mean, when you look at the way they played against Norwich, they made life difficult for themselves, and Norwich, it must be said, made life difficult for themselves. When you look at the first goal that Ronaldo scored, the defending for that was just horrible, really. It's those kind of rudimentary errors that do you no favours when you're trying to beat the drop.
No, as a manager, you're just pulling your hair out, aren't you? Because you're sitting there saying, we've started really well. We've carved open a couple of opportunities where you can see there's chances here. And then defenders go and do that kind of thing. And although you know you're down, there still can't be nothing more frustrating than saying, that's just not give goals away. But then when you look at that defending, it kind of just shows you why Norwich are where they are and why they're in the trouble they are this season, because they are just not good enough defensively for this league. But yeah, crazy, because they really had a chance in that game. But when you're going to give teams goals, then you can't help yourself, really.
And staying on that topic, a 10th successive home defeat for Watford. And I mentioned last week that the second goal they conceded against Leeds was a kind of microcosm of their season. I think they beat that last week with, what was it, 1-1 with seconds to go. They miss a near open goal. then down the other end, Brentford go and make it 2-1. It's just been nothing but disaster at home for Watford this season.
It has, yeah. And that's what's cost them, isn't it? You know, ultimately, you know, in this league, your home games are your games that you need to get those points in. The Leeds game was huge. I think that's just knocked the stuffing out of Watford now, to be honest. I think that result, I think they now know that, listen, we're done for here. We needed to get a result in that game. We haven't. And I think, again, this weekend is just another one where I think now you are sitting there saying, well, Watford and Norwich, they are gone. Is there still any hope for Burnley? Well, there is. But again, I think, you know, another defeat for Burnley. And if Everton kind of pick themselves up a result in the next game, then I think we're saying, well, that could be it. You know, Everton have got Leicester tomorrow. I think an Everton win there, and I think that kind of seals the relegation race for this season.
Yeah, I think Everton's fortunes have taken a massive swing in the last week by not playing. The fact that Burnley have sacked Sean Dyche, Burnley only got a draw at West Ham, so they played another game. Everton faced Leicester. Leicester are kind of focusing on the Europa Conference League, as we kind of witnessed on Sunday against Newcastle. So all of a sudden, that doom and gloom over Goodison Park has lifted quite considerably. But let's go very quickly to Tyneside, because Newcastle did win 2-1. Before we focus on the winner, that being Bruno Guimaraes, I want to focus on Kasper Schmeichel and the VAR decision of his first goal. It got to the right decision in the end, but is this another case of goalkeepers getting too much protection to start with?
Yeah, I think so. It's always been the case, isn't it, Dan? You know, a goalkeeper can come out with his knee in strikers' faces and that's all OK. But the minute a striker or a defender jumps with a goalkeeper and instantly the referee blows his whistle and, you know, it's a free kick, even though most goalkeepers are 6'7", when you then consider they're raising their hands over their head, you know, they do get far too much protection. And, you know, I think we were on the end of a really bad goalkeeping VAR decision not so long ago, and this was one that, again, you looked at and think, wow, they, you know, you've got very lucky there. And one where, again, it does prove that goalkeepers kind of do get far too much protection.
Yeah, it's kind of strange that it needed not only the VAR to look at it, but also a referral. I mean, you're looking at the replay from your house and you're thinking Schmeichel hasn't laid a single glove on that ball at any point. So where's the kind of indiscretion? There isn't one, really. I think the referee's gone to default mode and thought, oh, there's a challenge with the goalkeeper, I'll have to scrub it off. But luckily for Newcastle, it stood. And luckily for Newcastle, they kept going right to the very end. And Bruno Guimaraes, he's kind of been edged into the first team. But with a double against Leicester, you kind of feel that now they're going to build the midfield around him.
Yeah, we said a couple of weeks ago, didn't we, that you've got to use him wisely right now. And that is maybe, you know, away from home, he's not a player that you're going to put in your side because of what he, you know, the fact that he maybe won't do the tracking back in that. But when you're at home with the crowd behind you and you're in a more attacking state, he is definitely the player you want, and start edging him in that way. And he proved it this weekend, didn't he? Because, you know, those two goals, he's a firm fan favourite. He looks a really good player, so one that you can now assume will start building around him. And once he gets a little bit more Premier League toughness and experience behind him, he's one that Newcastle can start building the future on.
Well, that, and obviously with the shopping list being so big in the summer, he's got competition for places, hasn't he, Carl?
Oh, he will have, yeah. I mean, you know, once he gets Eriksen, once he gets all the, you know, all these other players around him, he may not even get a game this season, Dan.
Just a flash in the pan. We're not a flash in the pan, but we're off now because it's full time. So, Cole, just the admin, which is simple, is thanking you for wearing the captain's armband. A great show, and I look forward to doing it all again next week.
Yeah, absolute pleasure, mate. And again, looking forward to chatting all things Premier League, and I'm sure we'll have some more headlines we didn't foresee coming next week.
Absolutely. Right, cheers, guys, and also to the listeners out there. And with that said, it just leaves me to say that my name's Dan Tracy. This is The Real Football Cast, and until next time, goodbye.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Sports Social Podcast Network. New to the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hi, this is Nick Hancock, and if you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy ours. It's called the Famous Sloping Pitch Podcast, and it's Chris England and myself just having fun and then not having fun talking about football. Try it.